Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the session on Azure for IT Pros. Welcome. Just to give you a little bit of background, I was going to say I work out of the UK. I live in the UK, but I've got a sort of fairly global consultancy, and I do all sorts of strange things. I used to specialize very much in Active Directory, and then everyone decided they knew how to build their own Active Directories. And so it went on for a number of years. Interesting is, some of my larger customers are now coming back and saying, can you sort out our Active Directory mess? I've single labeled forest names and all those sorts of challenges that people are facing. How did I get involved in Azure? I got involved in Azure about 2 years ago, and maybe two and a half. One of my clients said to me, what we want to do is we want to get new e-commerce sites out there really quickly. How can we do it? Because everyone thinks they're going to be terribly successful with an e-commerce site, especially after they've been down the pub in the evening, drinking rather a lot of beer, and discussing selling the new Hoochie Coochie 2010 TechNet widget. And the problem is, of course, you've got huge upfront costs. And one of the solutions is possibly using Azure to solve that problem. So I got involved with them, and then I'm very much involved in the federated identity space. And of course, with federation, your authentication for your application, where is the application? It could be on-premise, it could be in a partner organization, or it could be in a cloud service. So what's really, really exciting is the announcement last week with the new, which you've probably been hearing lots about, with the new services for Azure. So what I want to do is cover off some of those. So how many of you are feeling sleepy at the end of the day? Okay, brain saturated yet? Yeah, probably getting close. So let's have a look at what we're going to cover. So first of all, I want just to briefly look at IT roles and challenges. And with those, of course, everyone said the cloud, there's going to be no job for IT pros anymore. I think you'll find there's an awful lot for you to do. And there's an awful lot for me to do as well. We're going to sort of do a quick intro to Azure. And then I want to look at deploying virtual machines. We'll want to deploy a virtual machine on a virtual network. What does a virtual network mean? How do we connect to that virtual network in the cloud? When you deploy a VM, it will have a public IP address, and it can potentially have your own private IP address. So how do we manage that? Do we still use jump servers and so on? Let's look at those. And then in terms of connecting on-premise to the cloud, this is where we connect the Azure virtual network to a VPN connection on-premise. So how do we set that up? And then I want to look at actually looking at what they now classify as cloud services. It used to be pretty much all that was in there in terms of running applications. It's been rebadged as cloud services. What does that mean to us? How do we manage those? And then finally, I just want to look at the access control service, which is now part of what they've reclassified as the Windows Azure Active Directory. At the moment today, the only thing in the Windows Azure Active Directory suite is ACS. It's the access control service. So we'll look at that as well. So what do IT pros do? Install server hardware. How many of you like being in a data center installing hardware? Yeah, just one person. I quite enjoy it, actually. But it does get a bit painful after a while, plugging all the network cables and things. Configuring the networks, very important for us. We've got installing the OS, and then, of course, update forevermore. And click mouse. Managing storage and backup, that's important to us. Applying security. Managing certificates, so actually, just a matter of interest, how many of you have a PKI infrastructure? So that's probably less than a quarter people in the room. Deploying applications and also monitoring applications, OS health and performance. And what's really key and what we should be doing is meeting the business requirements in terms of scaling to demand and also being agile. One of the problems with IT is, you know, you can get the managing director or the CEO has gone out and he's found this wonderful deal. He's going to merge two companies together. And you can see the poor old IT director is pulling his hair out thinking, how on earth are we going to cope with this? How are we going to cope with that change to our infrastructure? One of the big challenges is actually managing demand. And if we think about it, if we want to start selling something and we ask someone, well, you know, what capacity do we need? And then what they'll do is they'll think about it very, very carefully in terms of working out what the demand is going to be and then come up with a straight line. So then you sort of predict where you're going to start and what you're going to provide for a certain period of time. So that is our entry barrier. That's what we're going to have to sort of put together to actually make this thing work in the first place. And then sort of reality strikes in. And at some point, you scale. And you've done really well. You've scaled before demand has outstripped capacity. But selling these things has worked brilliantly. And suddenly, you're zooming up in terms of demand, and you're not going to meet it. So what you do is you quickly realize that actually you haven't got enough rack space in the data center, or you haven't got enough storage. And you end up with a delayed response. So what we've got here is we're under capacity, which of course leads to potential business loss. So now we're under capacity, nobody's interested in our site anymore, and it tails off. If it flatlines, you're doing well. If it drops, it's probably more like reality. So what we've got here is not only we've got wasted capacity, and then we're under capacity as well. And we can think about this in terms of the hardware, but it equally well applies to the software. You could have way more software licenses than you need when you are actually in the sort of wasted capacity area. This is a real challenge, and this happens very often. Happened in the UK with the ticket sales for the Olympics. You know, what happens is everyone has a look at the website and they're all cruise surfing it, looking at what's happening, and then suddenly the ticket sales open and you've got to predict what sort of capacity you're going to give. So you decide we're going to go for that. And what you end up is with these CLMs at the top. Anyone know what a CLM is? Yeah, well done. It's career limiting moment or CV limiting moment. And that's the sort of thing we want to try and avoid. If we go for a public cloud solution, it's on-demand compute and storage. So that's what we're getting. Internet-based. I put that up there because if you're taking an on-premise application and you're moving it into a cloud service and you're going to access it from the internet, be careful. Because you may have found that inside your nicely protected perimeter, right, there's no one to hack that application. But move it up into the internet, you want to be absolutely certain that app's gone through proper security development lifecycle. And you really understand that it is a secure application. You also pay for what you use, which is good. So we can actually scale up as necessary, only paying as we go. Delivered as a service, and this is one thing I wanted to say, is a lot of people have this expectation, and I come across it all the time, well, oh no, that's not right, that's not the way to do it. But the fact is, it's a multi-tenanted environment for some applications and some services, and basically, it's delivered the way the cloud provider is going to give it to you. So what you need to do is be very careful of the SLAs, and really look at those SLAs. Because I've seen SLAs where it's 99.99 availability, all right? And caveated later, it means non-availability is where you've got 10 minutes of continuous downtime. So in theory, you could be down for 9 minutes and 59 seconds, up for a couple of seconds, and down for another 9 minutes, and they're meeting their SLA. And I've worked with a company in the Netherlands, and they have 100% availability. And what they actually do is they've got an amazing team of people. They can't guarantee 100% availability, but they guarantee that they've got the engineers there at that moment to sort it out when it goes wrong. So they sort of sell it as 100% availability, but obviously it's caveated. And they've got they do a lot of the major banks in the Netherlands and major commerce sites. So be very careful, look at the SLA, and make sure it gives you what you need. So if we look at the Azure platform, what have we got? We've got the management, we then got compute storage, and we got SQL available to us. In terms of compute, you've got web roles and worker roles, and that's what it's been like for a number of years now, since it really released. And then last Thursday was the announcement of the websites and the ability to have virtual machines. Now, you may have come across and said, hang on a minute, virtual machines were there some time ago. Yes, they were in preview. They were also non-persistent virtual machines, right? Which basically meant if they got recycled, anything that you stored on that virtual machine was lost. The reason they existed was for you to be able to port applications up to Azure that took a long time to install. Because basically what happens is if you're putting an application up there, a VM is fired up for you, and that application is installed on it, right? And if it's a web role, worker role, that is very quick, right? But they wanted to be able to support applications that needed a longer install cycle so you could pre-install them, but they were non-persistent VMs. These are fully persistent VMs, VMs that we sort of know and love. The important thing about the management is, yes, there's the portal, but also it's got a very, very rich set of APIs. So you can do everything with PowerShell. You can hook System Center into it. You can hook your own proprietary tools into it to actually monitor and manage any of the compute storage instances up on Azure. You've then got storage. SQL, I'm just going to leave. It's SQL pretty much. You've got these things called blob tables and queues, and we'll look at what they are as we go through the session. You've then got various services on top, and the things like the access control service, the network connectivity is given to us via the virtual network, and caching capability. So if we've got a website where people are downloading content, we can cache that content around the world. So that rather than coming all the way back to our website when they're getting information down to the page, it can come from regionally cached information. So caching is distributed. So there's distributed caching available. Setting boundaries. This is actually a very interesting thing. Traditionally, a developer, they might have developed it on their own machine, but when it gets to production and making it available to someone else, they've had to come to us and say, you know, this is what we need for infrastructure. The problem is with Azure, that's been short-circuited. So Visual Studio tools load web and worker roles straight up into Azure, and you can run from there. You can do an update cycle straight from your Visual Studio tools, your development tools. And what we've got to do is actually take control back, because it's not just about putting that app up there. It's monitoring it. It's looking at performance and all the other bits and pieces. So if your developers have been doing that already, you've got to sort of draw a line and say, OK, that's your development environment. This is our production environment up in the cloud. And if you want it in production, so this is they then have tests. You have acceptance, which is a staging area you can use, and then you have production. And very, very important, as I say, you take control back on that. So, how do you back up? Can I come back to that? Yeah, very, very good question. You still need to back up, basically, but I'll come back on that when we talk about storage. So that is probably a portal, if you've been watching the various presentations so far this week, that they probably haven't shown. That is the original Ezekiel portal. It's still there, right? And you need it for certain things. But of course, the new portal is the squeaky clean, shiny one that everyone's been showing. And you can switch between the two. So let's actually do that. Let's fire up this thing and take you through on a sort of tour of Azure itself. Okay, so I'm running on my, I run Server 2012 on here, which is, I run all my VMs, and Hyper-V is now absolutely brilliant on 2012. So down here, I've got the original portal, and as we'll come back to this, because I need to use a service that's in here and only in here. But if you want to, you go visit preview portal, and you just click on there, and it will take you through to the new portal. So how do you get here? The best thing is you can get a free trial, and you just sign up for a free trial. And the interesting thing is, when you go back, so this is preview, but the other one's previous. And you know, if you read it too quickly, you might mix the two up. Anyway, that was just a by-the-by. Websites, if you want a website, websites are incredibly simple to create. And you can do it from a gallery. There's various options. If you wanted a blog, you simply come down and say, we want to do WordPress, next on there. And we use a MySQL database here. Now, this is important. At the moment, if you look at deploying an application, you can deploy it around the world. At the moment, what they've just got is Eastern US, North Europe, and West Europe, right? But you basically deploy this in the appropriate region. So that's one of the decisions you'll need to make. I'm not going to actually create one of these, but because I don't want the delay in actually doing it. But if I put a URL in there, click, and before you know it, you've got a WordPress site that you need to configure. Notice azuresites.net, right? So a lot of these things will be stemmed off Microsoft's domain names, so you need to use CNAMEs. So you CNAME your own name for your site to the Microsoft namespace. And if you're using, you know, HTTPS certificates and all the rest of it, if you've got an HTTPS site, then you do it exactly the same way. So CNAMEs is what's required there. So cancel out there. We've got virtual machines. I've actually got a virtual machine running. I've actually got SharePoint 2.10 running in the cloud. We're going to come back on that. Cloud services are, this is what was previously done as worker roles and web roles, and they were just referred to as hosted services. They're now actually referred to as cloud services, and I'm not going to wait there for it to finally get there. We're going to come back on that anyway. Oh, it's sort of got there anyway. So, but I'll explain this later on. So I'm actually running four cores. I'm actually running four virtual machines up in the cloud at the moment to support my particular set of cloud services. So if we pop back from there, SQL database, really simple. How long does it take you to build a high availability SQL database in-house? If you're in a meeting and someone said, we need a big SQL database. So here you can come up, you can go for the web edition or business, which you immediately get 10 gigs of space on. And again, really quick to deploy. So you can get a SQL running. In terms of storage, we're going to visit all this again. Storage, there's three different types of storage, if you remember. There's blob, there's tables and queues. We need to find out what they're for. And then we've got down here the virtual network capability. And we will come back to all of that very shortly. So in terms of web and worker roles, the concept behind these is that you have a web role where you connect into from the public network, and that is your front-end web role, and you know, HTTP, HTTPS, whatever you want to do, connecting into that, and you scale it up as you need to, and you scale it down as you need to. So if you've suddenly got, you know that you're going to have a whole lot of people hitting your website, you just scale up the instances you're running. And that in itself connects through to worker roles. Now, worker roles, if you like, are just really compute engines, right? They don't allow the user to, I mean, you could set them up to allow the user to connect from the internet, but what we've got is we normally just have those doing the compute. So if you were doing a financial modeling program and you had very few customers, but you need a lot of compute power, then obviously you scale up the worker role side and you keep just maybe a couple of web front ends. The communication is via queues and tables. And the best sort of analogy of that is, you know, if you look at Starbucks, they do a beautiful queues and tables system. And, you know, if you've got a lot of customers coming in, they upload the front end and people are taking the orders, taking the money, writing on the cups, and they get that is effectively going through the queue, and then somebody's rapidly making the coffee and then putting them on the table ready to be collected. And it's a very similar situation. The queues, you can have multiple worker roles pulling from the same queue. In terms of the web and worker roles, the applications are specifically developed for Windows Azure, right? You can't run them on-premise. So if you create these web and worker roles, you can run them in a test emulation environment, but there's nothing today that allows you to build a platform that will actually run them. Again, you pay for role instance. If you want the full SLA, which is 99.95, then what you need to do is actually have at least two instances running. In fact, I think currently they're running at about 99.98 as a delivery, but the SLA is 99.95. And you simply remove them on demand. And you could automate the adding and removing on demand. So what you could do is you could monitor, and then you can simply add more when when you trigger a particular level of activity. Microsoft could do that as well. The problem is, of course, if they did it, what are they doing? They're taking more money out of your pocket. So it's probably not the right thing for them to do, but it's actually something that you do yourselves, and you can automate the process of scaling up and scaling down. Load balancing, you don't have to think about it. Got one web role, got two web roles, you've got three web roles, four web roles. You don't think about load balancing at all. It just happens automatically. You choose your instance size, all right? Be very careful on this, because if you get a free subscription to try out. And how many of you have got the Microsoft Developers Network subscription? Okay, well, with that, you get a free subscription to Azure. Be careful of the level you're at, because there's an ultimate and there's a premium. If you've had premium a long time and you had an Azure subscription, they automatically have moved you to ultimate. But you actually need to make a phone call to find out which level you're on. Because I got caught by this. I thought, I've got small. I can run a small instance, 1,500 hours, which basically means two instances all continuous, right? And I thought, oh, I'll save a bit of money. I'll use extra small. They charge. So I actually got charged for using extra small instances. Be very careful that you keep using exactly the right instance. And you can see that you just choose the appropriate instance. So you can actually scale up and you can scale out as well. So when you fire up a worker role, it actually runs in its own VM. When you fire up a web role, it runs in its own VM. And that's the situation today. This table is correct today. It may be different tomorrow or the next day. And remember that you need at least two instances to get your SLA, your 99.95. You choose where the service is located. And what you can do is you can create an affinity group, because what you'll do is you'll create storage and you'll create roles. And you create an affinity group that guarantees they're in the same data center, but you can't choose the data center. So you choose, you know, Eastern US, somewhere there are data centers, right? They're very secretive where their data centers are. But what it will do is it will guarantee if you create an affinity group, they will end up in the same data center. Be very careful that you, because you could have worker roles in the US and web roles in Europe somewhere if you don't create an affinity group. In terms of storage, you can create local storage, and that can be actually allocated on a per instance basis. But be careful, because web and worker roles are stateless, which means that if they get recycled, that information is gone. So it's really treated as cache. All right, so you can cache stuff in there, but if, for instance, the hardware failed and they needed to spin up a new instance for you, you've lost your data. All right, so if you want persistent storage, you have to store it in persistent storage. This is actually very interesting that they're stateless. Because what it means is that you can just clone them. So you imagine that you build, how many of you built out a web farm? Yeah, just a few. Okay, so what normally happens is like Chinese whispers. You build the first server and you configure it and that's all documented. And then the next server gets built and the person remembers what they're meant to do. And then the next server gets built and they sort of remember what they're meant to do. And on it goes. And just every single member of the web farm is slightly different. With this, a worker role, stateless, just clone it. All right? And you guarantee consistency across your farm. Now, if you want persistent storage, you've got blobs. And blobs are just binary large objects. And you can create a VHD drive in a blob, and you can attach it to an instance. All right, so if we're running a virtual machine, it will be stored in blob storage, your actual VHD. Tables, remember, are really for output. So if you've got a worker role doing something, it will output information into the table. And queues are where someone at the front end drops something in and somebody at the back end processes it. And as I say, we've also got SQL Azure in there as well. Now, in terms of storage access, it's all done with REST APIs. So it's all things like HTTP gets and puts and deletes. So you can actually get to this storage from absolutely anywhere. If you declare some of your blob storage as public and somebody's got the URL, they just put it into a web browser and they've got to your storage. Right? So, if you have not got public storage, you've got private storage, and obviously you'll want private storage for your important things, what you'll need to be able to gain access to it is you will need a key that is automatically generated within Azure. And you'll need to actually use the storage key to gain access. There's lots of good tools that will allow you to connect from absolutely anywhere into the storage to gain access. So what I want to do is actually look at configuring storage and gaining access to storage. So if we just switch over on this. So I can go in here, I can go new, and I can choose storage. And you can just do quick create. You need a URL. So what should we choose in here? Let's try, I wonder if TechEd's been used. Yeah, it's already been used. So we could try and take out 101, 1010. That's okay. So my storage will be at teched1010.core.windows.net. Here's the affinity group. This one with the rather strange GUID was previously created in the previous portal. I can actually use an affinity group that's already been pre-created, and I create those, or you create the affinity group, Or I could just choose a region to host this thing in. So I could choose, you know, going to be somewhere in the US East. Now, this is, you're coming back to your question. When you create storage, what will happen is you automatically get three instances of this storage within a data center, all right? So now we got three instances of that storage. If one of them dies, they've still got two to connect you to, all right? But if somebody goes and deletes all the information out of those storage, that's entirely down to you. So you've got to be responsible for the backup. So again, if you've got a SQL table, you know, SQL, everything gets replicated beautifully. That's not going to disappear. But if someone drops the table, then it's gone. All right, so all they're guaranteeing is the integrity of the data. They're not guaranteeing any backup whatsoever. So it's down to you to back it all up. So all your backup plans and everything else you've currently got today for on-premise, you need to do also in the cloud. Notice the little checkbox, if you can see it, enable geo-replication. What that will do is it will take your three instances of the data and it will replicate them to another data center. So without that, if the data center completely vanished, you know, into a hole in the ground, all your data's gone, right? But if you choose enable geo-replication, it will replicate it. The only caveat on that, of course, is what? Price, yes. So if I disable this, it does actually, it does give you, if we just take that off, and then enabling geo-replication later can have a pricing impact. So it will cost you more because we're now, what will happen is there will be six instances of your data. But it does mean that if you were going to cater for a complete data center disaster, then your data is in another data center. Right. So, and that will take it across two different data centers. So the question is, would the data center be in the same region? Of course, it's a very good question, actually, because I actually asked exactly the quite same question of one of the Azure PMs yesterday. Because this whole problem, if it's in a different data center, it's a different part of the world, it's all regulatory compliance and all the rest of it. And I said, well, what about if it was in Singapore, in the Singapore data center? And they said they've got two data centers in Singapore for exactly that. So that was the answer that I got yesterday. But if we knew where the data centers were, we would have to be eliminated. It's completely secret where the actual data centers are. But as I say, very interesting question because it was exactly the question I had yesterday. Okay, so I'm not, if I clicked create account, what it would do is actually go and create the account for me, and we'd be sitting there for, well, 3 or 4 minutes while it actually created it. What I'm going to do is go to, you know, it's like the cooking programs. You go to the oven of one you did earlier. And what I've got up here is, and these are networks, under storage, I've got MySpace 101, and this I created earlier. And down here, you can see that you've got a URL for blob storage, you've got a URL for table storage, and you've got a URL for queues. All right. Oh, what I'm going to do is actually connect to this, and to do that, I'm going to use CloudX Explorer. And CloudX Explorer is a really quite nice program. It's a free download. So it's just CloudX Explorer, if you have a look. And I'm going to create an account, and I go new, and it was MySpace 101? I think that's what I called it. Let's just double check that. Yes, MySpace 101. Now, to access this, what I need is a storage key. So manage keys,
And I'm going to grab this key, and because it's being videoed, I'm going to delete this storage account immediately we finish the session, because otherwise you could go there as well. So I'm just taking that storage key, and I'm going to now go back to Cloud the Explorer and put that in, use SSL for the connection, OK, and if we go into MySpace, the folder's empty. It is empty at the moment, because I haven't actually got in there. So new container, we'll just call it test. Whoops, no, we won't. Yes, we will. And I can go into test, and I can go to my C drive. I can just grab this file, and I can paste that in. And that's now sitting up in the cloud. So that is now actually sitting up in blob storage. I'm going to look at this again when we actually look at running roles and instances, because I've got the use of queues and tables and blobs, and we'll see that in action. But I just wanted to show you how you can actually gain access and store things up into the storage place in the cloud. So if you're going to deploy a virtual machine, you need a storage account first, because your VHDs are going to be inside that storage account. Okay, virtual machines. And this is really now extremely interesting, because they are truly VMs, as we know and love, as against the non-persistent VMs that were around before. So if you're discussing VMs with someone and they say, oh, they're non-persistent, they were, but they're not anymore, all right? And you can bring your own, or you can use a Microsoft-provided, all right? You update and you maintain them. So if you take a Microsoft provided, you still update them. So what you could do is you could actually build in Hyper-V your own virtual machine using your own license for Server 2008 R2. And then you can put your applications on it, configure it exactly as you want to, and then upload that as a VHD into blob storage, and then attach a virtual machine to it. So you configure the virtual machine to actually use that VHD. So that's one option. But what they've done now is they give you a whole series of templates. And you can actually choose from those templates what VHD type you'd like. And I've not actually managed to see the pricing model for this yet. But in theory, what you're going to be able, you will pay for the virtual machine instance plus a little bit for the software that's running on it. So now you've got software pay-as-you-go. And at the moment, they're sort of pretty bare bones, what they've got up there. But you will be able to go into the gallery and choose a SharePoint instance. And you'll be able to go in the gallery and choose an Active Directory instance that's already got the role installed, ready to go for you. So all you've got to do is configure it. And SQL Server. So if you don't want to use Azure SQL, you can use your own SQL Server. Question?
Would it be possible to host an ADFS server
then? So would it be possible to host an ADFS server? Yes, absolutely, it would be possible. I mean, there's no real restriction of what you put up there. What I've got, you can put your AD up there, absolutely everything. And I'll talk a little bit more about that very shortly. Question here. Yes. Yes, so question about, I guess, are you, well, the question is, if the VM is set up, ready to go, you are paying for that VM because they've reserved it for you, right? You pay for storage size as well, all right? So you will, I mean, depending on how you buy it, you pay so much for your storage. Now, if you want to leave that VHD up there, what you can do is you can detach it from the VM, all right? So it's no longer set up, ready to go as a virtual machine, and it's sitting in storage. But yes, you pay for the storage. Actually, let's just flip over here, and because one of the interesting things is, you know, what is the pricing of all this stuff? And if we go back to, actually, I wonder if I can get back to the portal. I'll tell you what, I'm going to go into the, I'm going to try going straight into the Azure portal. There is a pricing tab. Pricing, there you go, that's the one I was looking for. And what you've got down here is a pricing calculator, so there's a full calculator. But SQL database size, you crank it up, and it's giving you cost on that, a bandwidth. And if you go to the full calculator, you can say, oh, yes, I want a small virtual machine, and this is the monthly charge, not the hourly charge, right? And the that over there is your per hour cost of running it, okay? On here, I haven't actually looked. Here you are, storage, geo-redundant. So let's say we bring it up to, I don't know, what do we need probably? Actually, I don't even think I can make it that small. So 100 gigs will cost you $12.50 a month. All right, so you can get quite a lot of virtual machines sitting at 100 gigs. So, but the very important thing is to remember to basically break down the virtual machine and leave just the VHD up there in storage. I've done events before now where I've had a very sophisticated environment in Azure, and then I forget to take it down after doing the event, and suddenly get this huge credit card bill. So do be careful. Yeah. Yeah, so basically you detach the VHD and you've got, so when you create a VHD, you've got the option of attaching to an existing, all right? So you can create the thing attached to an existing, or you can create the whole thing afresh. But have a look at the pricing model. There is nothing, I haven't been able to see anything on what the cost of, you know, having the actual software on there is at the moment. Of course, it was all just released last Thursday. Okay, let's go back to the slides. Yes, if you've got a single VM, you get 99.9% on the SLA. And what's happening is all the storage is virtualized. So you remember that it's all blob storage. So if your VM dies, they've just got a very fast way of attaching it to another VM and spinning it up. Okay. And in terms of connecting to on-premise, you can use the Windows Azure Virtual Network. Now, this is actually very interesting, because what it allows you to do is it allows you to take your own network up into the cloud. So if you're running on the 10.20 network, right, you can take 10.20 addresses up into the cloud. And in the cloud, you create a virtual network, you create subnets as you want, and then you connect through a VPN. So we actually have a VPN gateway that happens in Azure, you have a VPN gateway on-premise, and then you're connected. So what you could do is on your network up in the cloud, you could put SharePoint authenticated against your own AD. Right? Trouble with that is SharePoint is not particularly friendly at long authentication delays. Right? So, and Microsoft found this out with their Office 365 dedicated service. So what they want you to do is put your AD in the cloud. This is Office 365 dedicated. So they want to co-locate a domain controller, or a pair of domain controllers actually, up into the cloud where they're offering SharePoint online. So you should probably take that into mind, is if you're going to do this, you want to put SharePoint up there, you want people to authenticate against your AD, then maybe you need a copy of your AD up there as well. Question? Okay, so you've got a point-to-point VPN, right? So in terms of you're secure across that, Yes, we do have a public IP for each of those boxes as well, and I will come to that. Good question, because I'm going to come to that. Yes. Sorry? Okay, what do you need locally to set up the VPN? At the moment today, you need hardware, and it's limited to Cisco devices and Juniper devices. I'll actually show you in a second. We won't actually set up a VPN because I don't have the hardware with me, but I'll show you how it's done, and that probably will answer your question. Was there a question over there? No. Okay. So what I want to do is create a virtual machine, but before we create a virtual machine, we'll create a virtual network to put it on. You can create a virtual machine and just have it there not sitting on a network, but if you're putting your infrastructure up there, you'll want it on your network. So I'm hoping that I'm going to... Thank you very much. I'm hoping that I've still got my portal running. Yes, I have. Good. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll go, first of all, to networking. And I'm going to go new on the networking. So I'm going to create a new network. And I'll create a custom network. So you can actually have a configuration file which creates it for you. I'm going to create it. And by the way, everything I've done so far, you could have done with PowerShell. All right. So we'll just call this, I don't know, what should we call it? Net. Net one, I don't know, yes, 101. There you go. Again, where do you want this thing to reside? Because in theory, it could reside absolutely anywhere, right? But we would tie it to an affinity group. Next on there, you then define the address space. So let's put this in the 10.80.0.0/16. So that's my address space. And then if you want, you can create multiple subnets. All right, so I can now net that down. I could subnet it down with a /24 or whatever I want to do. So building my infrastructure in the cloud, all the servers could be sitting on different subnets. I won't bother creating different subnets here. Next on there. Now, this is rather strange. It says DNS server, and you think, what on earth does it want a DNS server there for? What it will do is, by default, it will actually create DHCP for you, all right? So the one thing it doesn't know is what DNS address it should use. So you can put your own DNS address in here. If you leave it blank, what it will do is it will point your server, right, to, through DHCP, it will point it to a public DNS server, all right? This is really just a way of saying, what DNS setting do you want in the DHCP server? Okay. Now, if you click on here, what it will do is this is where we set up the gateway, the VPN gateway between us and, between Net 101, which is sitting in the cloud, and our on-premise. I'm not going to go through this because it takes a while to create the gateway, but what I will do is I'll show you one that I created earlier. And just to give you an idea, so Net 5, if we look at that, what it's actually got is it's connected, and it's given me the IP address, which is the public IP address, of this end of the gateway. All right, so this is the gateway IP address into Azure. When I specified this and set this up, I had to tell Azure what my public IP address was. So it obviously could set up its side. Now, what's really quite nice is that you've got the ability in... Oh, I thought it was in there, but maybe it's in the dashboard. Yes, you've got the ability to download, and it tells you how to configure the other at your end. At the moment, there's Cisco, and you've got a number of devices there, and there's Juniper, and you've got a number of devices there. And, I mean, if we took one of the Cisco devices, let's just take that one, and we'll say okay to that, and download it, and then we'll open that. And, you know, there's the configuration. It's sort of telling you what you need to do to set this up. Okay, does that answer your question? Yeah, but it is, Today, it's limited, but, you know, again, only shipped, well, it only went into preview last Thursday. So expect this list to get longer. And I would hope it would include things like Windows Server as a VPN endpoint. All right, so, I mean, all I can say is I would hope it would. Okay, I haven't finished this, have I? So that sets the network up. So I'm going to cancel out of that. And now I'm going to go and look at setting up a virtual machine. So we come to set up a virtual machine, and we go new on there. Virtual machine, and what would you like to do? Oh, quick create, or from a gallery. And here, I can choose what I want to set up. So I could have a virtual machine with, you know, SUSE Linux on it, or with 2012 release candidate, or with, 2008 R2, or in fact, already pre-installed with SQL 2012, right? Now, the interesting thing is that when you do this, what it's asking you for is the virtual machine name. It's asking you for the administrator. In fact, and we'll just get past this page. So it's asking me for the core size, what I would like it to be. I'll stick with small on there. And then it's asking me for a DNS name of how I will get to this on a public IP. But hang on to that thought for the moment. Here's connect to an existing virtual machine. So this is how I can actually connect it to an existing virtual machine. And also, I can choose the virtual network. So I could go on Net5, or I could go on the CorpNet network. And that's how you set this thing up. Now, what it's doing here, it's effectively taking the stuff that it would do an unattended install with. So it's like an unintended install, and just pre-loading all of the information I've just put in. So effectively, what I've done is I've created a script to build this thing. Now, here's one I did earlier, and what we've got on here is I've got SharePoint 2.10 running, and if we look at this, it's actually struggling a bit because I actually decided to actually put it in what I was licensed for, but if I want to, I can change my size. All right, so I can just update that. The availability set is you create an availability set, and it's sort of telling Microsoft that these servers, right, at least one of them needs to be available. So if you do need to take down your infrastructure and fix it or do whatever you need to do, they guarantee that they're going to keep one of your servers up and running. So when you have an availability set, it means that your servers will be distributed and that they can maintain your service running even if they need to take something down and do some work. So that's what the availability set's for. Now, your question about endpoints. I've now created this server. It's sitting on my network, which is connected through. Right? It doesn't have to be. I could have made it all standalone. So the only thing it's got is a public IP address. Right? And this is the firewall rules for Azure. So what it's saying is, at the moment, what I've got open in there is desktop, isn't it? I can't see what it says from there. It's, oh, no, default site. That's interesting. Oh, sorry, that's my default site. Yes, sorry, I thought I was seeing it as remote desktop. Yeah, no, it's my default site, which is on port 80, right? So I basically said, open up port 80. But what you can do is you can open a port up and map it to some other port inside. So you can do port mapping. So I've got port 80 open up. I've got 443 up because SharePoint, I want to come to it and talk to it. And I've got remote desktop as well. If you don't want to come to it over a public IP, you just turn all these off and it closes the firewall ports. Right? And what's actually happening is it's taking the public IP and mapping it to your actual IP address of the server, and it's coming to those addresses on the actual server itself. So when I'm setting up SharePoint and putting an HTTPS certificate, I'm putting it on my IP address, which is the one that's set on the 10.whatever network that I set up. So, say. You'll have 20 IPs. You have 20 machines.
You only have one public IP.
No, you have a public IP per machine. All right. And you know, I mean, you can still do exactly the same things you used to do with jump servers. So you could actually have only the jump server open to the public, really harden that server down. So it's purely a jump server, which allows jumping off to your other servers. Or you could say, I won't have any public addresses at all. I'll come through my own internal network. And if something goes wrong, you just go into the portal and work from there to fix it. Because you can always open these firewall ports again. Because you close one off doesn't mean you lose the IP. And I think that's pretty much it for the virtual machine. So that's actually sitting up there running up in the cloud. We're going to come back on it very shortly. So that gets our virtual machines up. Remember these things. If you want to create these things, it's built by the developers. They're crafted for Azure. They'll need the Azure SDK and all the other bits and pieces to go with them. They create the binaries, and they also create a definition file. And the definition file has the VM size in it. There's a configuration file to go along with it. And the configuration file is the instance count. And so you can go in and modify the configuration actually in the portal and increase the instance count so you can actually scale it up. And there's two files. There's a CSDef and there's a CSCFG. You deploy it. They give you the packages, and you basically deploy them through the portal. I should have done a new screenshot for the new squeaky clean portal, but that's the old portal screenshot. It's exactly the same thing. You choose a package, choose a configuration file, and up they go into the portal. They can also do it directly from Visual Studio. All right, so they can actually be working in Visual Studio and basically say click deploy, and it will package and deploy directly into Azure portal. But that you want to keep for development. All right, for production, you want to keep it, control of it. Once it gets up there, what actually happens is it goes into the RDFE. Anyone know what the RDFE is? FE is for front end. Anyone know the code name for Azure? Red Dog. It's the Red Dog front end. So it goes into the Red Dog front end. And then what it does, it looks in the configuration file and everything else and says, ah, yes, I need this size VM, and I need this number of instances. And it just automatically deploys them through the fabric controller in the data center, and it puts them across multiple racks. All right, and I'll come back to that in a second. And then it puts in the load balancer, gives you a public IP, and away you go. Now, in terms of putting them across racks, there's this concept of update domains. And we can actually be in control of the update domain. So it means we can have multiple instances up there, and then if we decide to update, it will get updated one domain at a time, which means we remain available. And then there's the concept of fault domains, and with fault domains, this is just Microsoft deals with this. They're a similar concept, and they're just there to support hardware failures. So if you think about it, a rack is a single point of failure. So what will happen is, if you've got two instances, it will guarantee those two instances run in different racks. So if they do lose a rack, then you're still running in the other one. You've then also got staging and production. So you can upload it into staging, right? And remember, when you upload it, they're virtual machines they're running in. Each instance is its own virtual machine. If you upload into staging as well, there's more instances of virtual machines, so you've got the cost there. But then you can just do a VIP swap and swap between the two. So you can actually just swap between staging and production. So you could have production up there, you could upload your new squeaky clean version. You can get to it, rather than using your URL, you get a GUID generated URL. So it's very unlikely anyone else could get to it. You can test it through that GUID URL, and then when you're ready, you just do a VIP swap, and it just swaps the two over. So now you're running on what was staging has now become production. So what I just want to do is very, very briefly have a look at what I got running. So I'll just go back to virtual machines, and we're looking in here, this time at cloud services. I've got X-1 running up there, and I've actually got 4 cores of this thing running. And I'm going to actually go up onto the website itself. Oh, sorry. Thanks. So I've got 4 cores. You've got monitoring on there. You can look at the configuration, and we can see that we've got the endpoints declared in the configuration. We can look at scale, and I can, you know, go from 2 instances up to 16 instances, but I'm not going to do that for obvious reasons. I don't want to pay the bill. But we could scale it up, or we could equally well scale it down. And what I've got is I've got 2 web roles, I've got 2 worker roles. If we look at the instances, we can see them there, and they're all in a happy state. So if I actually go back to the dashboard, down here is my site URL. And if we go to it, what I've got here is actually showing me the fault domain it's running on and the update domain. And if I hit the F5 key, we might be lucky. It might switch. There we go. Do you see it's just changed from 1 to 0? So I was hitting the load balancer, and it's gone over to the other instance. In terms of blob storage, I can upload blobs to this. So I could browse for a blob and upload it. Having uploaded it, I've put this in public storage, so equally well, I can get directly to the blob. So I can get directly to it because I've actually got this. The blobs are in hosted storage. If we, let's go back here. If you're looking at tables, I've got a very simple table here. Let's just put SS, AA, FF, etc. Just load some stuff into the table. What I want to do is really just show you that you can look at this stuff. And my queues, I'm going to just put 20 item messages in the queue. Now, this whole thing of actually what's going on, well, you've got tools like, there's another tool which is actually very useful, which is Azure Storage Explorer. And I'm going to connect my XTS storage. And what I can actually look at is I can look at my blobs. So these are my blobs. There's the 2 blobs that are up there. I can look at my table, and inside my table, I can query for those messages I actually put in the table, so you can actually see the contents of tables. And you can actually look inside the queues as well. So if I look in the queues, remember I put 20 up there. There's only 11 left. Let's refresh. 11. Still 11, still 11, 10, 9. And what I've got is actually 2 worker roles dequeuing the information. And it's just purely for a demo to see. Because the important thing I wanted to show is that you can actually gain access to this stuff. You're in control of it. It's storage. And you don't have to sort of, you know, what's the developer doing? Why is he having a problem? You can look inside the tables. You can look inside the queues. So So how do we deal with demand bursts? Very easy. We just scale up instances as necessary, all right, and then appropriately scale down as well. And remember also that if you're using virtual machines and you've scaling up to support more demand, and those virtual machines already come with software on them, it's pay-as-you-go software as well. So it's a potential, well, could be a really good benefit. And the other thing is, of course, you can track demand. So your availability is always tracking demand. So that would make you a very successful IT person that can you match demand? Of course I can, I'll track it perfectly. So what about this? We've got this application that's on-premise, partner organization somewhere. We got a user, on-premise, partner organization in an internet cafe. And then we've got the user's identity, which may be coming from on-premise, is maybe coming from a partner organization, or some third-party identity provider. And how do we tie this lot together? Well, we do it with federated identity. So it's using WS Federation, SAML protocol, or one of the lighter weight protocols that you can use. I've got a SharePoint server sitting up in the cloud. How can I authenticate against it? Well, I could put my Active Directory up there. Alternatively, I could tell the SharePoint server to federate, right? And what you've got is inside Azure itself, you've got this thing called, well, it's called Windows Azure Active Directory. But don't look, I don't know, did any of you go to Stuart Kwan's talk on Active Directory for Azure? No, okay, he talked about it yesterday. It's will be in preview, which is a directory service, which is sort of much comes from the Office 365 directory service. So in the future, you'll be able to have identity that you can consume from Azure Cloud. But for the moment, it's ACS. And what ACS is, it's effectively a federation broker. So you can attach your app to ACS, and then ACS can talk to other identity providers. So what actually happens, you've got the admin portal there, obviously. The user hits your SharePoint server. SharePoint server says you're not authenticated. Redirects the user up to ACS, and ACS says, who would you like to authenticate with? And you choose, so you're pushed off to the authentication provider, and out the box, it's Live ID, it's Google, it's Yahoo, it's Facebook, you know, and this is extensible. You can also talk to your own ADFS server. That bounces you back with a token. You present that token back to ACS, why does that happen that way? Because everything is driven from the browser. So the identity provider can't pass a token to ACS. It has to be passed through the browser. You process some rules. You get back your token, which can then be passed to SharePoint, and SharePoint lets you in. So what I've actually got is sitting up in the cloud, and I thought this would be just such a fun thing to do. I spent most of yesterday evening doing it. It's very sad, I know. So this is my SharePoint in the cloud. Oh, I'm going to close that off because I just gave it away. I need a button pusher. So let's just look at this. Let's look at the properties on this. So can you see it's xts-sp.cloudapp.net. If I wanted to personalize that, I would have had to have CNAMed it. Okay, so I would need a CNAME in DNS for that. So I'm going to go off there, and whammo, I end up at, would you like to authenticate with Live ID, or would you like to authenticate with Google? Let's go with a Google identity. So just have to remember my Google identity. What have I used? Yeah. That's right. It would help if I had an S in there. Yeah, I just have to remember what it is. Oh, I don't want to stay logged in. No, put it. JohnCRA at xtseminars.co.uk. That should be correct. Sorry? XTSEM. Oh, yeah. I can't even spell it. I know. Yes, thank you. And there you go. Into SharePoint in the cloud. And I've actually got this little claims web part. So my name identifier, which is I'm using my email address here, my identity in SharePoint is 005.t. Azure ACS is my token service, and that is the actual value. These are very cryptic hieroglyphics. 5 actually means email. Dot means that it's a string value, and T means it's coming from a trusted source. And that's it. So that's actually using ACS to go and consume identity from other parties. It took a little bit of setting up, actually, even though I knew ACS pretty well. There was a lot of little tiny bits of tweaking that I needed to do. The ACS token lifetime is very short, and SharePoint immediately rejects it because the cookie lifetime is too short, or the token lifetime is too short. So you have to tweak things like that. So in terms of monitoring and diagnostic, very rich. You've seen some of the monitoring that you get directly in the portal. Previously, you got nothing in the portal. Bear in mind, if you turn on monitoring, where does it end up? In your storage. You pay for it, okay? And then, of course, you've got the ability of getting a really rich experience with System Center. So you can deploy your VMs, et cetera, through System Center. With the app controller, you can actually do all the management as well. And you could do all your scaling using that. And you could have workflows so that when you hit certain levels of actual performance, you could actually send emails and say, I think it's time you scaled up and things like that. So what do IT pros do with Azure? They don't install the hardware anymore. Configure the network. Yeah, for cloud and on-premise connectivity. So if you want to do that, you've then got to take the VPN skills. So that's another good place to be. Install the OS. Well, maybe. So that's why it's a dotted line, because you might create your own VMs. If you're using VMs, you update. If you're deploying worker roles and web roles, they are going on platform as a service. So the only thing you need to maintain is those. Everything else is maintained for you, all right? So there's a great advantage of actually using web roles and worker roles, but in terms of actually getting things in the cloud, all right, you're probably using VM roles. You've got to manage storage and backup, getting the right amount of storage, getting the right amount, actually backing the data up as well. Sorry? How do you actually manage the backup? You can actually just snapshot the disk, right? And you get a boot safe disk. I could actually just copy the VHD, attach a new thing to it, but it doesn't quiesce anything that's actually running on that machine. So you need to use you probably need at this point in time to look at third party solutions. And there are third-party solutions that will work and do that. Microsoft have been working closely with a number of partners to come up with a backup solution. Again, for the actually backing up the actual VMs itself, it's sort of early days for that. So I don't know what solutions are available, but I do know partners are working very closely to provide backup solutions. Well, if you don't want to back up into the cloud, if you don't want to back up to on-premise, back up into additional storage, which is geo-replicated. All right, so you can do that. All right, you could even decide that you want to use the bandwidth. You actually locate your backup in some other region, and actually do it that way. So you can actually create additional storage for the backup, or you can back up to on-prem. Managing storage and backup, applying security, managing certificates, deploying VMs and applications, monitoring. There's a whole bunch of stuff to do. One of the ones you can put a big tick against, though, is matching the business requirements by scaling on demand. So the top one I've actually put in managing images and libraries as a new task. So actually, Azure gives you the opportunity to really become the expert on scaling and agility within your organization. The other thing, it's a chance to innovate. Something that you've had on-prem that actually would benefit by being available to lots of people, you could move into Windows Azure and actually sell that service to the global market. So that's another thing to think about. And you know, if it's really successful, you can just scale it absolutely as you need it. So, my email's there. By all means, email me if you like, and some other bits and pieces and details. But what need to ask you to do is actually, if you can make sure that you, if I can get there, make sure that you get a chance of winning something. And if you've got any questions, by all means, get down. But we're right on time, so I'm going to close the session, but I'm very happy to answer questions. And thank you for attending the session.